such a great idea going trick-or-treating for Blu-rays around the Hollywood studio lots, Chris.
It was no easy task, and we spent a few $100s in gas, but it was worth it.
All right, so let's check out our hauls.
Whoa, I got Pacific Rim, The Heat, Defiance, and Love Actually. These are great. We should review these. What'd you get?
I got a rock.
Wait, what?
Yeah, my bag is full of nothing but copies of The Tooth Fairy.
Bummer.
Beer. Dastardly Digital Files, and welcome to another terrifyingly fun episode of Digital Noise right here on oneofus.death. I'm sorry, I went a little too Crypt Keeper with that one.
Man, if they did have a dot death, whatever. What do you call that?
I don't know.
Whatever it
a
is.
Domain.
A domain, whatever. If they did
what
that,
is it we do for a living
we
again?
We would have to buy that immediately just for the fuck of it.
Hell
I
yeah.
Would, in fact, I would start, I would just buy up death.death, death.death,
yeah.
death.death.death. I would just own them all.
Clicking on this will result in death.death. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Well, I am your horrifying host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined in this media tomb by my friend and cohort, Mr. Christopher Lawrence Cox.
It's very lovely to be here.
We're here to review all the Blu-rays. I do want to remind you that everything is available on iTunes, including Digital Noise and all of our other shows. So all you got to do is go on there and search One of Us in the podcast section. And hey, while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? I wanted to read this one here from Pistol Chris, who says, Digital Noise is the best podcast for anyone who loves Blu-rays and wants to hear the dirt as well as get pumped for awesome new releases. Also, once I was lost down a well, and one of us barked for help until I was recovered.
That's true.
I didn't make that last part up. He actually wrote that.
We did actually do that. That happened. It was true. It took a while to get through to Jane back at the house because she didn't speak oneofus.net. But eventually she figured it out.
I don't recall this, but okay. Apparently it happened.
You were drunk.
This is entirely likely. I also want to urge you to please consider becoming a subscriber. You can pledge $1 to $25 per month, or you can make a one-time contribution, whatever you can afford, and you can cancel anytime. We appreciate your efforts to help us keep providing you with content.
Just think of it as our tip jar.
Yes, a giant e-tip jar. That's exactly what it is. We would appreciate that. We have a great show for you tonight. Lots of fun titles, a giveaway from our past, and a very special guest, Mr. Matt Frank!
Yay!
Yes, yes, my children, I have descended upon high once more to grace you with my presence, and nobody's listening. Never mind.
Descended upon high?
Does upon that mean high.
He got here and immediately was like, where's the bong?
Yeah.
I can see my own hands through my other hand.
Our special guest, Matthew McConaughey.
Now, Matt, just for those who have encountered your particular form of genius before, why don't you tell them a little bit about what you do?
We'll call it genius, sure. I am the resident kaiju expert in a nutshell, but basically I'm a comic book artist for IDW mainly. I've worked on Godzilla and Transformers and Mars Attacks, and I've been around these parts for a while, so every now and then I harass Chris here to, pay attention to me and Give me more of the sweet, sweet airtime that I crave.
What did you say you were an expert in? What is it called? What's that word?
I almost said something like butts. kaiju.
That's Kai racist. But
to be fair, the version of Schindler's List about the kaijus is much more entertaining.
Yeah? Pacific List? Yeah.
Pacific List.
That's a good movie.
It's not quite as culturally or historically sensitive.
No.
But it's sensitive in any way. It sure is awesome to watch all of those concentration camp soldiers get stomped into the dirt.
That point when Schindler shows up at the concentration camp and he's like, and his tail is knocking over buildings.
You wouldn't You wouldn't think black and white and 3D would go together so well, but...
You'd think he would have been more on the Pacific front, but... Okay.
Well, Matt is here to help us review a very mysterious title that I'm sure you can't figure out by now. Happens to be right within his wheelhouse, but more on that later. First, let's recklessly fling open the ancient communication vessel known as...
The Letter Box.
Got mail.
Thank you, Torgo. That's right, the letterbox. And we have some great questions today. This one's a bit of a head-scratcher, I think. Tyler Mathiason, who I still think I'm pronouncing his name wrong, said, you have to choose one horror movie villain to hunt down, and then you have to choose one horror movie character to fight by your side. So you have to hunt a monster or a slasher down, and then you also have to have a monster or a slasher by your side to help you hunt that other monster or slasher down. Who are you hunting down, and who is by your side?
Well, I think I would hunt down Freddy, because mm-hmm. I'm used to staying up for just ridiculously late, just staying up for sometimes days in a row.
True.
Really, all you need to do is take a significant quantity of LSD, and you're pretty much fine for 3-4 days. You don't even know you're tired. Of course, on the other hand, that probably counts as the realm that Freddy can inhabit as well. But still, maybe I haven't thought this through completely, but nonetheless. And I think I'm going to go with, to help me, the devil from The Exorcist, because really, he's pretty much the king, I guess, of all movie monsters. So why not get the almost omnipotent king of all monsters? Sorry, Matt.
No. First of all, I thought you were going to say you were going to hunt down Freddy because you were threatened by his use of puns.
I am a little threatened by Jesus puns, but not in the sense that they're good, but that he's making us all look bad.
Yes, he's the one making
us
look bad.
Poisoning the well.
I don't know. It sounds like you said juice of puns, and now I'm just picturing an all new product line for oneofus.net.
Juice of puns.
This episode is brought to you by Pun Juice.
Delicious pun juice. Delicious pun kai juice.
Drink it down until all of your friends are groaning. Yeah, I think I would hunt down. Here's what I would do. I would get Jason Voorhees to be my partner, and we would do the one gimmick that franchise has not yet done, which is time travel, and we would go back in time to kill Dracula before he had a chance to become this weird little mincing, effeminate, whatever he's become in movies these days, where isn't he such a hottie? It's like, it's fucking Dracula! Like
100 years from now? This is totally going to be the equivalent of a Twilight series about Jason Voorhees.
Oh, God, you don't. No.
I'd be like, no, he's not rotten in this version. Instead, his skin is just kind of glowy.
Oh, God, they're going to ruin slashers. Maybe we just go back in time and eliminate Stephanie Meyer before she's born. Maybe you go Terminator style. I don't know.
You're like, you know what? Forget Hitler. Stephanie Meyer's exactly what
I want. I have my priorities, Chris. That's a horrible thing to say.
It really is.
Matt's got one. Yeah, go for it.
I was just thinking about this. First off, the hunt down, not necessarily a monster, depending on your definition. I'd hunt down Jigsaw and shut that whiny bitch up. Meh, cancer, meh, dead life, meh.
But he's dead.
Well, no. You go back and you...
Before he gets a chance to be
him, that motherfucker made 5 movies after he was dead.
He did.
Yeah,
he,
but you gotta get in there before he's like... Before he somehow cobbles together $15 billion or how much it costs to make all these elaborate fucking traps.
Yeah.
True.
And for my team-up monster, I mean, I have a couple of taller candidates in mind.
Maybe one with a purposeful grimace who makes a terrible sound and pulls the spinning high tension wires down.
Unfortunately, I think I would get cancer standing next to Godzilla, considering how
that's true.
Unbelievably radiotactive he is.
True. Mm-hmm. Not the best choice as a partner.
But I think as far as like horror movies go, I think I'd go with the Frankenstein monster from Monster Squad.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a good choice.
Because he's not like old school Universal Frankenstein. He's like, you know, he doesn't mean to be mean, but he kind of will just snap your neck. As opposed to this Frankenstein, who looks like he's actually got some restraint.
The Frankenstein's monster from Monster Squad is more like Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
True.
Yeah. You just gotta point him in the direction.
You wouldn't want him to go up against Godzilla, though.
No, although... There was a giant Frankenstein movie out of Japan.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Frankenstein Conquers the World.
No shit.
And this will be our next movie for Watch a Movie with Us.
I was gonna say, I have to
see
this now.
It's so amazing.
I would only assume that Dr. Frankenstein also was the size of a skyscraper just to be able to do this.
Well, it's funny. It's such a weird, screwed up, complicated story about the Japanese getting the heart of the original Frankenstein monster, and then they take it to a lab in Hiroshima, and then the bomb gets dropped.
Of course.
And the heart grows into a new Frankenstein monster.
The heart grows into a new... Because it's got irradiated, and anything can happen after that.
That's because it's...
Because science means shit all when it comes to radiation.
Well, they'll just look at Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's true.
And then out of nowhere, in apropos of nothing... A dinosaur monster shows up, and so they can fight.
As they do.
That's the whole point. It's like, it's Japan. This stuff just happens.
You know, I mean, there are. If you imagine a world in which there are, it's not abnormal to have giant monsters.
Everyone's sure. Like, yep,
when
all
a
right.
new monster shows up, naturally another monster goes, "Oh fuck that!"
I always loved the Family Guy bit where Mayor West was going to go roll around in toxic waste to get superpowers, and you see him jump the fence and start rolling around the toxic waste. And the next scene is you have stage 4 carcinoma. What the hell did you think was going
to
happen?
I
thought I'd get superpowers. Well, that's just foolish.
Foolish, yes. Idiotic, yes.
Just leave it at that.
That's it.
I love Adam West. Our next question comes from Neil Kelly, who says, "Dear Lords of the Digital, what horror movie has your favorite soundtrack outside of its primary piece of famous music?" He says for him, he loves the end credits music to Jaws as much as the main theme.
I'm probably going to go with Deep Red by Dario Argento by Goblin.
Yeah.
That whole soundtrack is just...
Well, anything by Goblin, really.
But that is my favorite out of all of them.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's not... I love the main theme from Halloween, but it's the chase music that I think is really... It's just dun, dun, dun. It's like, even though it's the simplest thing in the world, when you hear it, it's like, oh, get out immediately. Even if you don't see Michael Myers, it's like, that music's playing, get the fuck out of wherever you are.
You know what has great, and I just thought of this, some of the best, like, interstitial music that's not really, not even on the soundtrack, is Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
That da, da, da.
Absolutely.
It's not like a rock song. It's just really creepy, and anytime anything happens of import, the music starts again.
You're
okay. That's cool. And it has kind of a beat, rock beat to it, though. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like fits the theme of the whole. It's a bunch of punk rockers.
Absolutely. Well, guys, thank you so much for your questions.
Well, what about Matt?
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep skipping Matt.
It's like I'm invisible.
I have a script.
The giant monster guy is invisible.
I didn't think I put on that much weight. I was kind of rolling around in my head. And, you know, there's a film, it's a Japanese film, it's by the people who made Godzilla, it's called Matango, and it's a very creepy, very haunting horror suspense film from the 60s. It's about mushroom men, basically, but it's a very slow, very, very creepy movie, and it has this amazing soundtrack with these. It was some of the first experimentation in Japanese film music with electronica and electronic sounds. So it's like these little, like the little whistling and all that. It's just, and it's just all inside of this old ship, and there's rotting people in it, and gah. So it's a good one. It's a good one.
Never even heard of that.
It's really good.
I gotta throw in as well Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh yeah.
That whole score is just, I mean, I just listen to that score in my car. I like the score better than the movie.
I think that's a reasonable association there. Cool. Well, that's gonna do it for the letterbox. We're gonna close the lid on it, nail it shut, and consecrate the ground in which it is buried.
We should probably salt the earth as well. In case.
Just for good measure. But let us now move on to the reviews. And I do want to remind you once again that everything we talk about in the links below is connected directly to Amazon. If you click any of them, it'll take you there. If you buy anything there, even if it's not the item that got you there in the first place, whatever you buy actually does support the site, and we appreciate it. So if you're buying something from Amazon anyway, why don't you come to us first and then get there from us? Does that make sense? Is that convoluted enough?
I think we got it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I think there's
enough
no reason.
Selling, whore. Move on.
I don't think there's any reason to stand on ceremony. I think we're just going to go ahead and jump off with Pacific Rim.
You didn't see it coming.
You had no idea. We hit it so well.
Dun, 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 dun.
You thought Matt was here to talk about Love Actually.
How stupid of you.
I actually like that movie.
Of course you did.
Yes, as shocking as it may be to our listeners.
Shocked.
Although, there could be people who are like, what's this Mad Frank guy all about? What's he all about? Well, it seems like Guillermo del Toro must have asked, he's like, God, what movie could I make that Matt Frank will just poop himself in joy?
Almost guaranteed he made this just for you.
Yeah, I know.
Well, when I saw this, and I was one of the ones who really liked this a lot, and I understand the criticisms people had of it, but I just didn't think they were valid criticisms.
Right.
I was like, you know what? You wanted this to be a different movie, but there's nothing wrong with the movie they made. And I was like, you know what? I just kept refreshing your Facebook page because I was like, sooner or later, Matt Frank's going to have seen this, and I want to see what he's going to say.
Yeah, I saw it. Oh, my God. I saw it midnight. I was in Chicago at G-Fest, the kaiju convention that happens every year, and we had a midnight screening for it, and it was like being at SummerSlam. Every time a Jaeger threw a punch or a kaiju did anything,
everyone
was like... Growing
up in the bar industry, I can tell you, I've had a few Jaeger punches.
Those things hurt the next day.
They do. Yeah. They hurt right after you have them.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it was cacophonous. Just everyone was just, yeah, and oh, and oh, damn. It was really a lot. People were on their feet. It was a lot of fun. And the thing that strikes me, it's like, you're right, Chris. People really kind of feel like, it's almost as though there are a lot of people I talk to who don't like this film, and there aren't very many. I mean,
or people who are even like meh-ish about it.
See, that I could understand if somebody was like, eh, it was a thing. Like my fiance saw it, and she saw with me, and she was like, oh, that was a thing. Giant monster movies aren't really, she's not obsessed with them.
I don't have a problem with
that
at all. It's one of those like, look, it's just not really my kind of thing. I like a little more complex story than what that had to offer. It's like, that's fine.
Yeah.
But that's not really a criticism of the movie that wasn't trying to go that way.
Yeah, a simple story doesn't mean a bad story.
Exactly.
But here's the thing that bothers me is I will talk to diehard kaiju fans, people who know as much as I do, fucking hate it.
Really?
Every fiber of their... I
mean some, obviously, not all.
Not all. It's split down the middle, I'd say. Maybe not split down the middle, but there's a very vocal section of the fandom that is like, it's not just like, oh, I didn't really care for this movie, or oh, I think it could have been better. It is like, God damn it, I can't, oh, I hate this movie so much, and well, so why do you like this, you ugly fuck?
What's the criticism that they have?
Apparently it's that.
It's like, it's not that the movie's bad, it's that Matt Frank is so ugly.
It was just like a really personal attack, I don't understand.
You know what, it kind of skirts that line in a few places. Like, I've got a friend of mine who, after we saw it, and I love this guy to death, but he's basically spent 20 minutes practically shouting atop of his lungs how much he hated the film when we got out of the theater. And I'm like, I don't understand. And I keep trying to ask people, like, tell me what the problem is. And they'll be like, oh, well, the story's really simple, is too simple or something. Or, I didn't like the characters. What didn't you like about them? I didn't like the characters. Like, I think what it is that for kaiju fans, specifically, and mecha fans, people who've grown up on this stuff, a lot of the stuff that's in this film, we've seen. Like, a lot of this has been covered in other media.
That your average American audience going to the Cineplex has never seen.
Exactly, and I think that's part of it. They really want something that was going to break new ground and do something really different. And when it didn't do that, they got frustrated. So, I don't know. Some people I've talked to are as upset about Pacific Rim as they were when the American Godzilla came out in 1998.
Which, the American Godzilla was pretty bad.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, I heard somebody say that right after we came out of this, and I couldn't even say anything to him.
That's like, ridiculous.
I was like, that's just being silly.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I'm being hyperbolic.
I'm pretty lukewarm on Pacific Rim, and even I would be like, that's just fucking ridiculous.
What the hell is he doing here?
I mean, here, I will tell you exactly
what. belong here, Brian.
I will tell you exactly what my problems are, and it has nothing to do with the characters. I wasn't a big fan of the way the bigger action scenes were shot. I thought they were just a little... For the amazing scale and these incredible creatures and robots that were constructed for the movie, designed for the movie... I felt like I wanted to see them, their movements more in full, and I felt like it was a little too tight, and I hated seeing it in 3D because it was way too fucking dark.
We didn't see it
especially
in 3D,
since a lot of the fight scenes take place at night on the water.
Well, the biggest problem, I think, was that it was a similar problem with a lot of films in 3D. Is
right.
That, especially if you're where you're watching it doesn't have the super bright bulbs they're supposed to.
Yeah.
Now, I have not gotten a chance to rewatch this on Blu-ray, so I'll be curious to know.
The Blu-ray is spectacular.
The Blu-ray does look good.
Probably a lot more vivid, but yeah, I had the same experience watching it live. Like, I wish that it wasn't quite as dark as it was during some of these actions.
And then my other issue story-wise had nothing to do with characters, because like you guys said, like, I knew what kind of movie this was going to be from the trailer, where there's a robot dragging a fucking ship behind him to smack a monster with. Like, they've pretty much set up exactly what they're going for. My only problem is, like, they also created these other, like, apart from our main Gypsy Danger Jaeger, they created all of these amazing other Jaegers that I was like, I can't wait to see what they all do. And it felt like they were just decimated way too early. I was like, no, I wanted to see more of those robots.
Well, it was one of those stories like that you'll see. I mean, hell, it was like a martial arts competition story where all these fighters, and they're all like, they're especially in this style, and they all end up, when the big baddie shows up, getting their asses fucking wiped, and the underdog steps up and is like, I'm the one.
Did too good a job developing those or designing those other Jaegers, because I was just like, man, I want to see what that fireball does. I want to see it, like, really take it to a kaiju. And I felt like, oh, well, I guess we're done with that.
I mean, I can understand that. But for me, I looked at it as though we're getting a vertical slice of what's a pretty complicated universe. I mean, everything's very well designed and well thought out. It's funny, I follow the screenwriter on Tumblr, Travis Beecham, and every now and then he'll answer a question that somebody asks him about the film, and it'll be something you'd think would be a plot hole, and he's able to just pull this answer out of his ass, where it's like, oh my god, it totally makes sense now.
Yeah.
Like, and so it's really clear that he and Del Toro were really invested in making this a really detailed universe. As a result, you get this stuff that you get a little taste of it, and then you never see it again.
Well, see, that's kind of what I liked about it. That was the way I felt. Like, I like this for the same reason I like movies like Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah.
That there's all these points where they go, look at that thing over there. That could be awesome. And that's the last time you see it. And you're like, because they're creating the sense of a much bigger universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're showing you more than enough cool stuff happening.
Right.
But they want it to seem like, wow, you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg of what's possible here in this world. I mean, certainly Guillermo del Toro said in the beginning, he hoped this would turn into a franchise.
Right.
And now that over time the movie has made, it's like a number 6 for the year, biggest moneymaker internationally,
I think it was 400 worldwide last I checked, which is, respectable.
Enough that it definitely made a profit.
Right.
And it's doing very well, presumably, on Blu-ray this week.
And there's the fan base that has come out of this is really amazing. Amusing. It's like it was very kind of strange watching a new subsection, a fan base, kind of grow out of this film, and then now they're kind of getting into the kaiju fandom. The two fans are kind of intermingling, and somebody who knows the name of every single kaiju in Pacific Rim will turn around and say, "Who's King Ghidorah?" And I'm like, okay, let me tell you King Ghidorah.
But that's the dream for you guys, right? That you've got this whole new generation of people who suddenly are really interested in kaiju and all the other things.
The only fear, I think, would be something like, they would be like, yeah, you know, I watched one of these Gamera movies, and these are stupid. Why are
you
like,
shut up! You shut up
you
die!
You shut your whore mouth! Yeah, so, I don't know.
Wait, here, I'm sorry, let me put the robots on in front of it and then try it.
Well, it's good to know you guys went into discussions with people who didn't like it with an open mind.
Well, now, to be fair, like, we did talk specifically in the beginning is saying, like, look, the biggest problem I've had with people criticizing this film is they refuse to be specific about their problems with it. They're
specifically rimmed?
Their vagaries about what they didn't like about it.
They're non-specifically rimming this.
The characters were dumb. The story was too simple. I'm like, okay, once again, there's nothing wrong with a film with a simple story. There's nothing wrong with that at all. If it's filled in with all the other parts with stuff to keep you entertained,
yeah.
and without it seeming dumb. And there was nothing in it that made me... About the dumbest thing in it is the scientists fighting with each other, and that was a necessary comic relief thing.
Right, it helped to add a little bit of levity to what was happening.
I'm not a huge fan of Charlie Hunnam as a leading man. I think he's great on TV, and I think he's been great in other stuff. But again... I wasn't expecting an Oscar-caliber performance from the leading man in Pacific Rim. That being said, Idris Elba in this movie is fucking fantastic.
Well, I would.
Because he's Idris Elba, and he's fantastic no matter what he does.
For weeks.
Every night when he goes to bed, his wife turns to him and goes, "Oh my God, you're fantastic."
First,
like, I just got here.
Don't you ever touch me again. Second, don't you ever touch me. That's what he says to her every night. I didn't say you'd have permission to actually touch me, woman.
For weeks going into this movie, I was anticipating, and I couldn't wait for that moment where he would deliver the speech where he says, "We are canceling the apocalypse." That became my mantra. And then when he actually said it in the theater, I was just like, oh, shit, yes.
That's the thing. It's like, I know people like to make fun of this movie and call it silly. I know it is silly, but yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. It's good silly. It's fun silly. People, the same ways people make fun of Independence Day. And
entirely the Independence Day speech.
The Independence Day speech transferred into this universe, and it was that moment, too. I was waiting for it. I was like, oh, I can hardly wait for the Independence Day speech. Well, with Idris Elba doing it instead of Bill Pullman? I'm sorry. That's a step up.
And I also love the fact that Guillermo del Toro, toward the end of this film, is just turning up this giant middle finger at was it Universal who canceled his At the Mountains of Madness movie? Because the whole ending of this film is like, wait a minute, is he gonna fight Cthulhu? Like, is the last Jaeger gonna fight Cthulhu?
Basically,
it really feels like it.
That would have been pretty awesome.
You watch that, and you're like, I'm pretty sure this was originally at the Mountains of Madness screenplay.
I don't know. I sure like to watch that's one of the things Cthulhu mythos needs is, man, people need giant robots to fight these things. Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Well, what else is gonna fight them, quite frankly? I mean, you make a movie. I mean, like, Lovecraft stories are like, it's a guy, he gets curious about something, he finds out more than he should, he dies because he never had a chance against ancient gods, right?
Yep.
That cause insanity when you even think about them too hard. You pretty much have to have a kaiju fighting giant robot,
right?
You know, but you know, like, you know, in the way that Lovecraft stuff has been dealt with, in that they're always kind of from an alternate dimension or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sort of, it very well could have been Cthulhu's coming through for that interpretation if you want.
I would not be surprised that, God willing, we get that sequel they're writing.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if we got something that looked vaguely Cthulhu-esque coming out of whatever new portal's gonna open.
The upshot is, this is not, nor was it ever going to be, everybody's cup of tea. But for those who it sounds like it's going to be, that you should definitely give this a shot. Don't listen to your friends or naysayers. Experience this
for
yourself.
Don't listen to your friends.
No, experience this for yourself. Make up your own mind. Don't listen to some people who told you it's bad.
Yeah.
I think this is genuinely a really fun film and worthy of watching and rewatching.
And don't like be deterred because this is something completely new.
No,
that was a thing that
let your friends be deterred.
That was something that was.
Oh yeah, classy humor on one of us.
That's what we're all about here.
That was one of the things that did ultimately hurt it at the box office was because it was a completely new property. It wasn't Grown Ups 2. So
please don't remind me Grown Ups 2 exists.
Did
we miss that Blu-ray release? What a shame.
So give it a shot.
So. Now, this, of course, is out on Blu-ray, which means lots of features. Guillermo del Toro doing commentary is always a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, he can seem a little too precious sometimes in real life on things, and when you see him at festivals sometimes, you're like, okay, dude, shut up and let's watch the movie. But in sense of a commentary, he is exactly the guy you want doing the commentary.
Well, he's a giant dork like us.
Yeah,
like,
he's filled with passion. He's very funny, and the commentary here is exactly what you'd expect. There's 62 minutes of focus point featurettes.
Those are incredible.
Which are available individually or with a play all icon. Now, you watched all these?
Most, if not all of them. Like, I stayed up all night working the morning this came out, and then it was about 7 a.m., and I was like, oh, you know what, I bet Walmart has Pacific Rim out on shelves by now. So I hopped in the old truck, and I just spent the morning watching them until I couldn't, you know.
Defying the will of change.org for your Pacific Rim Blu-ray.
They had the best Blu-ray cover. So, yeah.
I see.
I definitely went through most, if not all of these, and there's a lot of really great.
That's that guy, like, you know, I would have voted to repeal slavery, but God damn it, if Slaves R Us didn't have the best Pacific Rim cover. Oh,
how long did you think slavery was going to last?
I'm sorry, I just saw 12 years of slavery.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm all angry. I can't even look in the mirror.
And now he's thinking of going to Walmart for $12 to save, so yeah, exactly. There you go.
There's also an interactive presentation of Del Toro's Pacific Rim notebook with clickable pages that access interview pods, image scans, yada, yada, yada. There's a 17-minute thing on the digital artistry of Pacific Rim, which is, of course, one of the more interesting factors about this movie. Now, what is the Shatter Dome?
The Shatter Dome is the...
That's what I call my penis.
No, it's not.
No,
but it is now.
that's the big command center where all the Jaegers are. Like every country has a Shatter Dome in it, and that's where the Jaegers come out of.
Okay, so, and this feature is an archive of the film's key design art.
Yeah, that is such
that.
An amazingly designed just space.
And there's 4 minutes of deleted scenes, 5 minutes of a breakdown of the film's four drift sequences. Can you say what that is?
That's when you connect with your pilot when you get into the Jaeger, and every one of those scenes where they go and it's all goes all blue and you see the kids playing or you know, oh, it's his brother or whatever, or their parents, that's all shot live action. They even shot they took the little girl who played the young Mako and filmed her like getting a wooden sword for her birthday or something and being like, yay, I can hit people now. And they filmed that, and then, like, you only see for a fraction of a second in the film. But, that's what that is, and it's pretty fascinating stuff.
Last up on here, of course, is the You've Gotta Have It blooper reel, which is 4 minutes, and of course, it's pretty much Charlie Day and Ron Perlman but anyway, this
We're gonna need another kaiju!
This is a solid release, well worth your time. In fact, if you had a definite... If you had a feeling about this when you first saw it, it wasn't exactly what you thought you wanted and you were disappointed, go back and give it another try, quite frankly, with different expectations.
Oh my God. Can I use that? I'm putting that on my website. Matt Frankly recommends. Oh no.
No.
Now
was
I
wrong.
Said it and now it hurts.
That's what happens.
So now
that
Larry,
I've said it out loud.
You must be a trained professional to use these puns.
I guess I'll just stick to art, I guess.
Probably for the best. Well, thank you so much for joining us, man. We really appreciate getting your input on a film that is in, you're in your element.
It's
in your wheelhouse.
Maybe when, the Godzilla Blu-ray comes out next year.
For the new movie. Who's doing that? Gareth Edwards?
Gareth Edwards. Mm-hmm. And, Meth. What's his name?
Walter White?
Thank you. That guy.
Meth.
Cranston is one of the leads. And all I have to say is Meth, and everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about.
I totally missed the trailer that was online for 5 minutes.
It's like...
It's more of like... I don't know that I'd even call it a trailer. It's like a sizzle reel. Yeah.
It was a...
Like a proof of concept.
Proof of concept, thank you, that Edwards put together, but it's...
It's still pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Matt, thanks, and where can people find your stuff?
Well, my main website's mattfrankart.com. That's kind of a hub for everything. I've got a Twitter and a Tumblr, which are both Spankzilla and or Spankzilla 85. Just type in either of those until you find something.
Brian's face says, I'm looking for a porn pun right now.
Nope, not going to do it. That's beneath me.
Nothing is beneath you, sir.
No, it's not.
Yep, and that's about the gist of it.
All right.
And also, go to your local comic book store and buy Godzilla Rulers of Earth, now on shelves.
And, oh yeah, and buy the new Rage Select t-shirt, which is...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, who cares about them?
Don't be like that.
We love Rage Select. Go buy their new t-shirt.
I listen to them. I think I listen to them a lot more than you guys. So.
Aw, don't. Now, see?
Way to end this on a high note.
Too far the other way.
I love you guys.
For this next title, I defy you, Chris.
Me?
I don't know, but you've seen Defiance Season 1 and I haven't, so this one's on you.
What were you going to defy me?
I don't know. It's a segue. Just, I don't fucking know. It's late.
It is a little late. Sorry about that. We might be a little goofier than usual today, and now that Matt Frank's not here to fill in the
Yeah.
Goofy gaps.
No, it was nice to have a break to not talk for a minute. I actually think I took a nap there for a couple seconds.
Well, Defiance is an American sci-fi TV series that is just now starting its second season that was developed by Rockne S. O'Bannon. And this is what actually, and some other guys, but fuck them. But Rockne S. O'Bannon is the one I was interested in, which drew me to this because he's the guy who created Alien Nation, the great sci-fi film. He created Sequest DSV, a very underrated sci-fi television series. Farscape, one of the best sci-fi shows ever.
It's an impressive resume.
And some shows I never heard of called The Triangle and Cult. I don't know what those are. But that being said, Defiance is very much in his, it's in his wheelhouse of the way that he likes to create a big world, right? Like, that's not limited at all. And here, this takes place on the Sci-Fi Channel here, and there's various international markets that airs elsewhere. It's set in the year 2046. Earth is really different, which has changed, like, you know, through basically bombardment by alien races and massive warfare, causing massive changes in topography, the extinction of lots of plant and animal species, the birth of new plant and animal species. And it series this guy, Josh, follows this guy, Josh O'Nolan, played by Grant Bowler, who's pretty much like he's the Han Solo of the wastelands. He drives around, he tries to find what they call crashed arcs, which are ships that basically in the last big war have just slowly disintegrating in space. And occasionally one of them crashes to the planet.
Huh.
He goes in, finds them, and steals basically stuff from the wreck.
He scavenges.
Yeah. And he does this with his adopted daughter, Arisa, played by Stephanie Leonidas, who is an alien herself, a hottie. She looks like what's the name of the chick from The Fifth Element?
Oh, Lilu.
Yeah, she looks like Lilu, but with her forehead was slightly indented.
Okay. So Lilu with a head injury.
Yeah, with a head injury who'd kind of put a little tattoo around it
to
draw attention to it, which seems like a terrible idea.
I've got the visual.
Which he basically saved her when she was just a little girl and then adopted her. But they're driving around doing their thing, and they end up in a situation where it makes sense to finally put down roots in this town called Defiance, which is basically St. Louis. It's the ruins of St. Louis. Like, most of the arch is still there.
Oh, okay.
And all these different alien races live together there that over the years have come to a sort of cold war of a peace. Like, they all are basically, you know, getting along's not the right word, but they're living in more or less peace.
It's sort of a mutually assured destruction kind of a peace.
Well, not really. I mean, everything's very tense. Lots of races constantly have their eyes on each other. Everybody is kind of out for themselves, but they realize the advantage of not being openly a jerk, basically. So everybody has their own agenda, is what it comes down to. And he agrees eventually with Julie Benz, who plays the mayor of Defiance, who's barely hanging on to her job by a cunt hair, pretty much. Is that appropriate? Can I not say that?
I don't know. I mean, I think
that's a real expression.
It's a unit of measure. I think I've seen it in the back of my Mead notebook, like on the conversion table.
He's talked into becoming the new law keeper, the sheriff of the town. And that right there should tell you everything you need to know. This is a Western about a guy who, like, the outsider who's not entirely happy about this, but for now it's the best job to protect the only thing he cares about, his adoptive daughter in this town. And as it is, it's actually a pretty entertaining series. If anything, it suffers a bit from trying a bit too hard to be too much. Kind of the way Babylon 5 was at first, where it was like, we're trying to do all this stuff and this huge amount of characters.
So it's reach exceeding its grasp,
At least for the first season a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, not so much that it really outright, like, it makes it a bad show or anything. It's just, there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's kind of hard to keep track of everything. And there's not everybody's not given enough time to care about them, but so much. As is Grant Bowler as Joshua Nolan is not the world's best actor. He's doesn't have that essential charisma a character like that should have. He's no Nathan Fillion, in other words. As much as they wish he was, oh God, do they wish he was? He's not. But there's lots of good stuff here nonetheless. I'm definitely going to keep on watching this. It ends with one fuck of a cliffhanger where, like, almost pretty much every major character is stuck on the edge of a cliffhanger at the end of the season. And that's saying something, because there's a lot of major characters in this thing. I actually really recommend this. Overseeing the whole season, ended up kind of falling in love with it. And it's one of those shows that I suspect is going to grow into its big boy clothes as it goes along.
That's a good way to put it. I like that. Well, that is Defiance Season 1. From there, we're going to call in The Heat.
Did you watch The Heat?
I did. I saw it in theaters, actually.
Wow, there's actually a movie you saw in theaters that I didn't lately.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the weird things about running your own site is all of a sudden you don't see as many screenings as you used to.
I still have to.
And actually, I didn't see this at a screening. I saw it like the weekend after. I was like, oh, I'll go check that out.
See, the thing is, I really didn't have much interest in this. One,
I'm with you.
I don't, Paul Feig so far, like everybody loved Bridesmaids except me.
I didn't either. That's crazy.
I thought it was pretty lame, actually.
I thought that if they had taken the time to develop the characters past the whole, we're taking a stand because we can do gross out humor too, it's like, yeah, but that can't be all your character is.
But it's not fair for me to judge him just based on this, because this guy also co-created Freaks and Geeks, which is one of the best shows ever.
And he's directed some great moments in television over the last...
The Office, yeah. Arrested Development, 30 Rock, Parks and Rec, Mad Men. I mean, this guy's like television career is impressive, to say the least. Mm-hmm. But I think I was a little disenchanted with Bridesmaids, if for no other reason that it felt like he was just trying to copy Judd Apatow's formula.
Well, yeah,
just with all chicks.
Yeah, well, I will tell the other reason I was not super excited about this is because there was still the bad taste of Identity Thief in my mouth, and I was so over Melissa McCarthy. I was just like, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But the one thing I do really love is the buddy cop genre.
I am a big fan of the buddy cop genre, so. And specifically what was going on with it in the 80s when I was growing up, you know, watching all of the 1,000 or so buddy cop films that came out there. I loved that genre, and this makes no bones about it. It wants to be one of those movies. I mean, hell, it doesn't want to be. It is.
It
one of those
absolutely
movies.
Is.
Substituting, you know, two mismatched guys with two mismatched girls.
Yeah.
And to be fair, as much as I think this is a far from perfect comedy, Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock have fantastic chemistry.
They absolutely
together.
Do.
They are really why this movie works as much as it does.
Yeah, and it's weird because as far as like the loose setup of the film, it really does feel like it's from the 80s. Like it's very basic with like, we've got to stop XYZ, so even though we're from different sides of the tracks, we have to work together. I mean, it's the most basic setup you can think of. But these two carry it and make it something special. And I liked that McCarthy was a little bit more, I don't know, I don't, reserved isn't the right word, but she was a little bit more relatable as a human being than she's been.
As it went along.
Yeah.
Because the first 20 minutes of this film, I was almost ready to turn it off because she was being basically her Identity Thief character if she was like a biker redneck. You know, it was like, come on. She's literally like cussing out her boss who's like cowering. And I'm like, I'm sorry, how is she still a police officer at this point? I'm just absolutely baffled that this world exists.
I enjoyed that.
Fortunately, it's not long into the film where she mellows out enough that she's like, they pull her back enough that she becomes just plain entertaining. And the mm-hmm. give and take between her, who is very much so like, you know, the rough, scary, I don't give a fuck cop, and Sandra Bullock, which is the very smart, but so by the book and so condescending that nobody likes her FBI agent,
yeah.
that they find this balance between each other to keep you not caring that the plot is pretty ridiculous and doesn't... I can't even tell you what the plot was about at this point. And I just watched
It's really
this.
Just the two of them taking down a drug dealer.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Pretty much. It's a series of silly set pieces, but a lot of stuff that did work, surprisingly, in this.
Yeah.
I was entertained by more of it than I wasn't. Nice appearance, but not big enough by Marlon Wayans. So I think,
yeah, Marlon Wayans was really good in this, and I haven't said that about him in a long time.
But he's not in it enough. You're like, why didn't they do
Which is also something
this?
We haven't said about Marlon Wayans in a long time.
Michael Rapaport is in this and is pretty good. Jane Curtin has a very small but funny role in
the
here.
The entire scene with Melissa McCarthy's family had me in stitches. They had, like, the most ridiculously heavy Boston accent. So one of them tries to ask Sandra Bullock if she's a narc, but he keeps saying, are you a knack? I'm just going to ask you one time.
A
are
knock?
You a knack?
And a knock?
Am I a knock? What do you say? A knack!
Yeah, having been to Boston, I can tell you I've had that conversation. In fact, they were asking me if I was a knock. So. lots of Nathan Corddry, Bill Burr, Michael McDonald, Tom Wilson, Tony Hale. This has just got a great cast of comedy stand. Like, you'll recognize almost everybody in this fucking movie,
yeah.
quite frankly. Even, what's his name from Back to the Future?
Tom Wilson.
Biff.
Yeah. He's the one that plays her emasculated captain.
Completely. Has anybody seen the captain's balls? They're like little ball bearings.
That's kind of why I liked that, is like, in all of the buddy cop movies, there's always the just exasperated, screaming captain. And in this movie, they made him like such an ineffectual dolt that she just pushes around all the time.
I think that was the point where I was like, okay, I was having trouble buying into it from the get-go, because I'm like, why would he put up with this for 2 seconds? It's like, wait, I'm the boss. You're fired. but I guess presumably the reason is because she's too good, even though we never really see that.
No.
But there's a lot of bonus. I mean, a lot of bonus
it
features.
It is a crap ton of bonus features.
They do not fuck around with it. You know, I mean, this is one of those comedies. You're like, every single feature is basically like, here are deleted scenes / gag reel version / alternate takes of scenes. That's pretty much what all the sequences are.
There's like four different gag reels on this thing.
Well, that are just called gag reels.
Yeah.
everything else is a gag reel, pretty much. But the best thing about that, okay, first off, there's multiple commentaries. One is the director talking about it. Another one is Melissa McCarthy and a lot of the other cast, but not Sandra Bullock, shooting the shit about it. Another one is basically the people playing the family of Melissa McCarthy on this, shooting the shit kind of in character. But the one to get this for is the original lineup from Mystery Science Theater 3000.
How did they do this?
Because Paul Feig is a huge fan of MST3K and just basically told his agent to make the right calls.
It's incredible.
And this is like literally the original Mystery Science Theater
lineup. Yeah, it's the original.
Which shows
crew.
How much of a dork Paul Feig must be for Mystery Science Theater. And the thing is that this isn't a prepared MST3K one. It's not like they watched it repeatedly and got a chance to prepare their jokes. They are just doing a commentary, like watching as they go along and off the top of their head. And so, yes, it's not up to the level of the top Mystery Science Theater stuff, but it's still pretty damn funny.
And the fact that this is a special feature on the Blu-ray makes it my pick of the week automatically.
Why isn't this a special feature on everything?
Thank you! Who do we have to call to make that happen?
Anybody that thinks of us as well as when they can't get Mystery Science Theater to do it. We are available!
We are, and we work very, very, very cheap.
And not all that hard.
Yes, exactly. Probably embarrassingly so. But that is The Heat, and from there we're gonna jump to Jumper. Jumper's that one with the Samuel L. Jackson and the kids that can teleport,
Hayden,
right?
Hayden Christensen. This is actually based on a book I loved when I read it originally, and its sequel that was written by, and now of course I just said that, I can't remember the name of the goddamn guy who wrote, Stephen Gould, who actually is one of those guys who just writes fun action-adventure books with like a sci-fi theme to them.
Gotcha.
And the basic concept here is that there are people that are born that have the ability to just teleport, and no big whoop-de-doo about it, no big effort, they can go, what, just teleport like crazy without a second thought.
Yep.
Pretty cool concept. And the downside of Jumper is there's not a lot of evolution of the idea here outside of that concept. In fact, the villain is so one-dimensional, played by Samuel Jackson, that outside of the fact they've dyed his hair white, his only defining feature is that he's a religious fanatic that likes to kill jumpers because they're unnatural, and not much more exploration is done than that.
So Jumper takes place entirely in Florida.
Right? Now, that being said, the plan when they made this was always to go this to be the launch for either going into a TV series or continuing on with more movies, like preferably more movies. Like, even with the book like takes off right where this leaves off, and a lot of the elements that appear in this are there as just teasers for what's to come. It's the first chapter of a bigger story. Jumper, as of yet at least, has never gotten a sequel, even though it actually performed extremely well in theaters, but it generally got a negative review from critics, which mainly criticized how limited the plot was. I myself, watching this film with Hayden Christensen and Jamie Bell jumping all over the goddamn place, getting in fights that take place in like every city in the world in the space of 30 seconds, with pretty impressively. I mean, there's a scene where a guy teleports out and then teleports back in with a London City bus to throw at a guy.
And
I was like,
awesome.
Okay, that's pretty fucking awesome. Yeah. Okay. That was really awesome. There's lots of shit like that that's really fucking cool in this movie. But yeah, it's super simple. There's not a lot of complexity to this plot. None of the characters are terribly well drawn out here, but everything, especially when you get to the end, it's clear they're setting up for what happens next that we never got to see. You can read the sequel, I guess. But I actually enjoy this. My main complaint was that Max Thoreau in the beginning is playing the lead character in this film, And then it switches to like 8 years later. Okay, he's learned to be a jumper, and now he lives in this fucking loft, and he's got everything. He's fucking rich as shit, because anytime he wants money, he just teleports into a bank vault and fucking takes it. You know? No, who can trace that shit? You can't trace that shit.
Wasn't that the senator's, like, big concern in the first X-Men? Like, what's to stop her from walking into a bank vault? Maybe the senators were right.
Well,
Sentinel program, go!
In this case, they would have been. But even though he always leaves notes saying, I'm sorry, I will return it. Because he's a nice guy. But basically, his Achilles heel is the girl he was in love with when he was in high school, played older by Rachel Bison.
Bilson.
Bilson. Mm-hmm. My problem is that I really was enjoying Max Thoreau in the high school sequence of this. I thought he was great and really, he brought this charisma to the character and this sort of sense of awe I loved. But then it's like 8 years later and it's Hayden Christensen. I'm like,
that's not a trade-off.
Was there any real reason to switch to Hayden Christensen? I mean, Max Thoreau at this point looked old enough that you could have believed he was 8 years older at that point. And yeah. Hayden Christensen looked young enough that you could believe he was 8 years younger. Sure. So it was just very like, wow, wait, what just happened?
Yeah, how drastically did you really change in 8 years?
Yeah, I was like, it's just kind of an odd decision to make.
Yeah, that sounds like a producer's note, frankly.
But, you know, the best thing about this film is really, and okay, so a lot of people were very critical of this, and I think I've always thought that one of the reasons was because this was just a little bit pre the modern superhero film era, where we're just constantly being hit with superhero films. And this is a very basic superhero movie, but a superhero movie nonetheless, that features pretty impressive special effects, really inventive fights, and a cool concept.
Well, I mean,
but
this is really,
wanted more.
This is really on the cusp of that era you're talking about, because it came out the same year as Iron Man, and Iron Man was really the kickoff of the sort of super contemporary. I mean, you had the Raimi Spider-Man stuff, but even that was sort of the exception and not the rule. And then once Iron Man hit, that really changed the scope of superhero cinema. So
and
I can see how.
And it was low budget and low concept by comparison.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, in the wake of stuff like that, of course, it got, you know, lowered down, but it's not like it's a great film, but it is a pretty neat film.
Yeah.
And I still, watching it again, I went, I still like this. I think it's a lot of fun. There's some fights in here that are really impressive to watch, and I would wish that they would, I hope that whenever they bring Nightcrawler back into the X-Men, mm-hmm. they pay close attention to what happened in this movie with the fights, because they're pretty cool the way they do them. Michael Rooker plays his dad in here. Always good to see Michael Rooker. Diane Lane plays his mother. Like I said, Samuel Jackson is just plain silly, but he's Samuel Jackson. Kristen Stewart has like a 20-second role at the end, which is like, nobody knows who Kristen Stewart is yet.
Those were better times.
Yes, they were. And she, even then, she's like biting her lip and looking like she needs some acne cream. Anyway, I like this, but unfortunately, the only special feature here is that it comes with the option of watching it in 3D if you have a 3D television, which, who gives a shit?
Is that the reason for the re-release?
For the re-release. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. I've always felt bad for Doug Liman. I feel like he's a good director.
A very good director.
Who's just never really gotten enough of... I mean, like, Jumper made a shit ton of money. It made $200 million.
Made a lot of money, yeah.
So it's not like this was a failure for him, but in terms of, like, kind of getting the critical reception that he deserved, I mean, he did The Bourne Identity, which people really dug, both critics and fans, and then Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which about half of the two audiences I mentioned liked.
I liked Mr. and Mrs. Smith, for the record.
No, I did too, but it wasn't something that was like a runaway critical success.
No.
And then from there, he's just been kind of, you know, you got Jumper, and then he did a sequel, a direct-to-video sequel to Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And
really? He did a direct-to-video sequel?
Yep.
Oh my God, that doesn't bode well.
No, but there is, there's been announced that Jumper 2 is in the works. So.
I mean, didn't he also do Go and Swingers?
Yeah, but that was before.
Right, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, he did, absolutely.
The guy's clearly capable of making great films.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I really just hope he gets an opportunity to be more showcased in the future.
Indeed.
But from Jumper, we are going to move on to Maniac.
You're maniac, I know.
And I'm slashing up all women that I see.
Or some word that rhymes.
No, I can't be bothered with rhyme.
This is a 2012 French-American remake of
William Lustig's movie,
which I hesitate to call a classic.
It is a performance piece. It is, as a film, it's not great. As a performance piece for Joe Spinell, it's pretty dazzling, and there is some really cool effect stuff in there. I mean, it's an early Tom Savini film. It's also a film where Tom Savini shoots himself in the face with a with a shotgun because he is both he has both created the fake head in the car where he was the actor, and then he is also the stunt double for Joe Spinell jumping up on the car with the gun.
That's pretty meta.
So I mean, there's some cool stuff about the original that is sort of canon. But this remake takes that concept and does something I thought was pretty interesting.
It does something drastically different.
Oh, very different.
To be sure. This is a completely different type of film than the original. And I would argue a much better film, quite frankly.
Technically, yes.
I really enjoyed this remake of Maniac much more than I thought I was going to. And of all things, it casts Elijah Wood as a serial killer. Elijah Wood, who is, okay, for the record, tiny,
super small,
and
guy.
Like the least threatening person you
super sweet guy
ever met. Like, really,
yeah.
And he pulls off the acting performance arguably of his lifetime here, because he makes this character so in depth, so convincing, so believable, as the basically the same setup for the previous film, and the idea that his mother was kind of a prostitute type woman of loose virtue, mm-hmm. And a drug addict who would do all that shit in front of him. Gradually he went crazy. Now he's a grown up, occasionally flashing back to that stuff as he kills women and then slices off their hair.
Makes mannequins.
He scalps them and puts them on the mannequins that he has,
which is a great carryover from the original. What's really fascinating about this film is that it takes the visual construct of a found footage movie and puts it into a film that is not found footage. No. And what I mean by that is it's entirely first-person perspective.
Yeah, it's
But nobody's filming anything. We're just seeing everything through the character's
eyes.
The
whole film is from the viewpoint of Elijah Wood.
So we actually see him we see Elijah Wood very rarely in the film.
I mean, enough that you don't feel like, oh, somebody else is doing it. Because apparently, from reading about this, he did all those scenes himself.
I totally believe it.
Never anything he wasn't on set for. But do you... How best to explain this? Okay, so it's all through his eyes, and there's various scenes where you see him in mirrors, whatever you like that. But the only time we don't see it like that is sometimes, and not every time, but sometimes right after he kills someone, the camera suddenly pans out.
Yeah.
And you actually see him for a second. Like those moments that he's in that high or low or whatever.
Where he's literally stepping
outside
of himself.
Literally stepping outside of himself. Yeah. And it really works. It takes a movie that is a relatively simplistic serial killer story, a lesser Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer in some ways, and makes it much more than the sum of its parts by creating a super unique and creepy atmosphere by putting you right into the shoes of the killer.
Yeah.
And it's very well filmed. It's very creatively filmed with the way it does this. In fact, obviously very difficultly filmed. I mean, every single scene in this had to take immense amount of pre-planning and blocking to get right.
Yeah.
And it also is scary and super fucking gory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is exactly what a lot of people are looking for. I mean, this is going to satisfy the gore hounds and the hardcore horror fans. But it's also a beautifully shot film, a very artistically done film. And oh, my God, what a score.
Oh, God, a terrific score.
Robin Coderre is the name of the person who did the score for this film. And it's got a very sort of syntho vibe to it, but it's also very foreboding. It doesn't feel so synthy to the point where it's precious or overly nostalgic.
Yeah.
It's the perfect ambiance for a film like
this. It's like somewhere between the soundtrack to Drive and the Goblin soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really impressive and stands out. There's a lot here to like, and I think that only people who are the most sensitive against horror, who are like, oh, I can't take anything too scary or too graphic, are going to have problems with
this. Which is both a valid concern and sort of a compliment to the film when you really think about it.
Of course, this comes with audio commentary from Elijah Wood, the director and executive producer, over hour length making of, which of course is something you'd be interested to see considering
for a
it looks
film
like
this,
it was incredibly difficult to make. Poster gallery, a few quick deleted scenes, the trailer, that's about it. So not a lot extra, although an hour long making of is pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. But ultimately you're here to watch this movie, which I will definitely be going back and rewatching it. There's a lot of technique that's so beautiful. There's a lot of Elijah Wood's performance is just knock it out of the park, and just I kept feeling as I was watching it like I was just not quite getting everything that the director was laying out for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's too many things going on that are that smack of subtle metaphor and of like things that are happening just to the side of the frame that you just missed that make you want to go back and give this another round.
Right. No, I agree with you. I really, really dug this remake. I'm really hoping that more people see it and experiencing it, and there's this is not the only William Lustig remake on the horizon, so hopefully that Maniac Cop remake will be...
I know, that's the one you're waiting for.
Oh my God.
Which is not a sequel to Maniac, for the record.
No. William Lustig managed to do a movie called Maniac, and then three movies called Maniac Cop, so... The guy likes the word maniac. What are you going to do?
Maniac, it's a good word.
It is a good word.
You know, good word.
So from Maniac, we're going to race on up Notting Hill, which is a film I have never seen.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm a Richard Curtis fan. I like Richard Curtis a lot, and I actually was very cynical, not having seen very many of his films at first. One of the person who convinced me to take Richard Curtis more seriously was actually C. Robert Cargill, who was a huge fan and started saying, you gotta climb out of your own ass and admit there's nothing wrong with admitting that you were completely charmed by a really well done romantic comedy. And quite frankly, nobody does really well done romantic comedies like Richard Curtis. His career has been next to flawless for me when it comes to his films, with the possible exception of him having written the sequel to Bridget Jones, which wasn't very good, but it was based on somebody else's book. So what are you going to do? But right from his first film, The Tall Guy, with Jeff Goldblum, a terrific movie, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Bridget Jones' Diary, Love Actually. Okay, so I don't like the Mr. Bean's films.
Well,
either,
but to be fair, he only created the character.
Yeah, true.
He didn't write those
movies. The Boat
movies.
That Rocked, which was known here as Pirate Radio, which I absolutely loved. Okay, so I wasn't a big fan of War Horse either, but he just was one of the writers involved with that. And his most recent, About Time, which I really enjoyed as well. Notting Hill, surprisingly, out of that list of films, and this being the first time I ever saw it, maybe my, like, except for Pirate Radio, maybe my favorite, actually. Now, while this didn't quite give me the type of nostalgic, enhanced, like, remember the loves of your past gut punch that movies like Love Actually did, it still had one of the more endearing plots and best comedy out of any of these. This came out in 1999, and the idea was that, every man hero Hugh Grant,
Charmingly
befuddled Hugh Grant was the best guy in the world at playing this type of role for about a decade, owns an independent travel bookshop in Notting Hill, which is a very sort of like, I don't know how to describe it, like the Village in New York or something
like
that. It's not really posh. It's, a bohemian.
Okay.
You know, lots of arty types, lots of street markets, that sort of thing, but where rich people go to do that sort of quaint shopping.
Right.
He's divorced, shares his house with a complete loser played by Reese Evans. And this was largely Reese Evans, like big, like breakout film, who's extremely funny in it. But anyway, he's working at a store one day and huge Hollywood star, Julia Roberts, who in this movie is named Anna Scott, but there's absolutely no reason they couldn't have gone with just saying she was Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
I was baffled why
they didn't go the Ocean's 12 route and just make her Julia
Roberts. I thought
it
would have been pretty awesome if they had just stuck with making her Julia Roberts, because there's really no difference here. She's this big Hollywood star, like the one who's like America's sweetheart type of thing. And they paint her as that. She comes in to buy.
Which is funny because in the movie America's Sweetheart, she doesn't play that character.
Exactly. She comes in to buy a book. They have a meet cute that sort of develops over the space of 20 minutes that's pretty well done and makes you root for Will, who she leaves the situation with giving him a real kiss for just flat out grabs him, plants one on him and leaves. And he's like, anyone would be under the circumstances. But, you know, he goes, you know what? That was an awesome situation. But you know what? I'm not even going to tell people what happened because nobody would believe me anyway. And they wouldn't. So days later, it turns out that some American girl named Anna, according to his roommate played by Reese Evans, had called and mentioned some totally different name at some hotel she's at. I don't remember. And for you to call her. Well, he works it all out. And basically it develops into a situation where they start dating, but all the problems you would expect between a normal guy and a ridiculously huge celebrity develop, and they get together and break up several times over the length of the whole film, basically. That being said, very funny, very charming, just lots of great supporting characters, which is one of the things Richard Curtis is great at building, is all these characters that are very funny in it. And just at the end, you're like, I mean, you're rooting so hard for them. You're like, they better get together. I swear to God, I'm going to write Richard Curtis a letter right now.
Dear Richard Curtis, where do you get off?
You son of a bitch. I swear, I'm going to come to your house. Anyway, this is a new Blu-ray release of this, and maybe the first one. I think it's the first one of it. And it's, you know, there's no really no extra features to speak of on the whole. Nothing elaborate anyway. But if you've never seen this, it is really worth your time. It is absolutely charming. It makes you believe in love.
Get the warms and the fuzzies.
It does. But probably not as much as the next film for some people, which makes sense to segue into. So
that is correct. It is Love Actually.
Now, this is the 10th anniversary edition. Oh, it's been so long. 10 whole years.
It was so long ago that Liam Neeson wasn't killing people regularly every January in theaters yet.
I was actually a critic at this point. I saw this in the theater with the Spill Crew when we were called The Real Deal.
You say that as if that's not what you are now. Back then I was a critic.
Well, I mean, it was 10 years ago. You're like, oh my God, 10 years. It's been longer than that even. But this was a monster hit for Richard Curtis and just in general. This was one of those ones that you could not get your woman friends to shut the fuck up about for like 2-3 years afterwards. And the only real difference in this edition and previous editions is that it's packaged with a Christmas ornament. Yay.
Hey, you get a
little flat Christmas ornament. Yeah. But anyway, this actually is a pretty charming film. And so far that I'm aware of, I can't think of another really good anthology romantic comedy.
No, there's a lot of them that are terrible.
That are all ripoffs of Love Actually. Yeah. Every last one of them, and they all suck. And none of them are by Richard Curtis.
Here is my dirty confession. I am not a huge fan of Love Actually. But the thing is, it is in fact an anthology romantic comedy, and there are vignettes that work really well. And there are some that just I felt a little unsatisfied by when they reached their ending.
There are certain ones that, okay, obviously is an anthology type film like this where it's not just an anthology, like they're not like, and now this story, and now this story. They go in and out of each other.
They intertwine.
Characters, like, yeah, they intertwine.
Kind of like a Quentin Tarantino script. You know, okay. When you have all these different things going on separately that then intertwine at certain points.
And certainly, they're not all as strong as each other, which is inevitable. And there's even one I outright dislike. The one about the British kid who goes to America because he decides that American girls are going to be like nobody likes him in England, but if he goes there with his accent, he can pick up anybody he wants. And it's like fantasy wish fulfillment, and that's it. It's like the sex story in there. Well, hell, there's several sex stories in here, technically. But it's, you know, I mean, he's in there and he ends up with, oh God, who is it? It's like,
isn't Katherine Heigl one of them?
No. It was January Jones.
Oh, January Jones is one of them.
The girl from American Pie. The sex girl from American Pie. What's her name?
The sex girl from American Pie?
Well, the one he has sex with on video.
Shannon Elizabeth.
Shannon Elizabeth, yeah. Mm-hmm. The girl who plays Jack Bauer's daughter on 24.
Okay.
Like all these really hot chicks who are all like the moment he shows up, oh my God, your accent is so cute. And that's the entirety of that story.
I actually forgot that Andrew Lincoln from Walking Dead was in this.
Was in this. But like you've got a story like Bill Nighy is very funny playing like basically Mick Jagger or something like that, who hasn't done anything for a long time. He's
Christmas
aging.
Is all around
and
us.
He puts out like a Christmas version of one of his classic songs. And
yeah, that is funny.
He's trying to promote it. And it's a pretty funny story. There's kind of a slight story, like you said, with Andrew Lincoln playing a guy who's in love with his best friend's new wife. His best friend being Chiwetel Ejiofor, who we're just going to see now in 12 Years a Slave.
Such a great actor.
And Keira Knightley, who plays the girl, of course, he's in love with. It actually plays out pretty cute. I mean, one of the things to say about this movie is that it's about all different types of love. There's familial love.
Yeah, yeah.
There's unrequited love. There's, there's quite a bit of requited love, but you know, the different types of love. Colin Firth is a guy who's a writer who falls in love with his new maid who can't speak a word of English and he can't speak a word of Portuguese. Alan Rickman is a guy who's a managing director of a design agency who's married to Emma Thompson, whose marriage is just kind of frigid at this point. They get along great, but there's nothing going on there. And he's falling for his secretary who's basically doing everything but spreading her legs for him on the desk. And his wife is trying to come to terms with the fact that it looks like this is happening. One of the best stories here is Hugh Grant, who's the prime minister, and he's falling for the sort of the the number one servant in the house, basically, this girl. They keep calling her fat, and there's, like, nothing fat about her at all, which is one of the only things I did not like about this movie.
It's the Mindy Kaling problem, where it's like the Mindy Kaling project. They keep making all these references to her being fat, and I'm like, she's not fat
at all, not even slightly. Like, and the same thing here. We're like, wow, she's super hot. Why would you think call her fat? And it's like running jokes. Even at the end, Hugh Grant makes a joke to her face about her being fat, where he's like lift carrying her out of the airport and goes, oh God, thank God you're so heavy.
Jesus Christ, I remember that.
Yeah, I was like, why is that there? Liam Neeson has, you know, the familial story where his wife has died and his stepson, Sam, who is absolutely adorable, played your actor, Thomas Sangster, has fallen in love with a girl in his class. And there's a big elaborate thing where his dad's trying to help him.
That was actually probably my favorite story of the whole bunch.
Probably mine too. Laura Linney has a story in here where she basically wants love, but doesn't know if she can get it because she has to take care of her mentally disabled brother. Martin Freeman and Joanna Page, who is gorgeous and is naked the entire fucking movie, are people who have the most bizarre job ever. They're body doubles for the sex scenes in a film.
Yeah.
And so every scene in it, they're naked and like faux having sex while having a conversation surrounded by a giant group of people. And it's like a meet cute in that they're already kind of having sex.
Yeah.
But they're like feeling each other out to see if they like each other, which is actually a pretty cute story. And Rowan Atkinson has a very small piece in here that's actually kind of forgettable, but ultimately this all comes together to a very cute, very feel good movie that both effectively makes you feel good nostalgia for Christmas's past, for love's past, for family love, for all the types of love it wants you to feel. It works more than it doesn't, although I certainly don't think this is his best film. It's no wonder that this had as big of an effect on people as it did.
Sure thing. Well, that is the 10-year anniversary of Love Actually, replete with Christmas ornament.
Christmas ornament! You know you want it!
And from there, here's a film I've always wanted to see. I think I actually own a VHS of this, but I've never seen it. Is Orson Welles' The Stranger.
Yeah, I actually barely found time to watch this. They sent another film with this from Kino, The Hitchhiker, that I did not get time to get around to, but maybe next week.
Well, they're supposed to be sending me that as well, so.
Okay, well, there you go. But The Stranger is actually one of those Orson Welles films, I've always heard about and never seen. It's not just starring Orson Welles, which it is, but directed by Orson Welles, one of the relatively short list of films he directed.
Yeah.
But a pretty
prestigious list of films that he directed.
Oh, most certainly. I mean, this is a man who made Citizen Kane that is often listed as the greatest movie ever made. Agree or disagree, there's a significant amount of people who feel that it is.
Agree or disagree, it's hard to argue that Orson Welles was a great director.
Major impact on American film. And this is actually, at the time when it came out, this was his most successful film he had ever made. And it's odd because this is one of the few films by him that went into the public domain.
Yeah.
Yeah, when the producers never renewed the copyright in 1973. And it's a relatively solid film. I don't think it's a work of art the way, like, say, Touch of Evil is, or The Third Man, which he did not direct. Or am I getting that backwards?
No. Carol Reed directed The Third Man.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought.
But he's great in The Third Man.
Yeah. Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this idea here is that he's a guy who plays a school teacher who we find out right from the beginning is not really a school teacher. He, in fact, is a German spy who is in America, who's hidden himself inside of this small, sweet, all-American town where he's marrying the daughter of a Supreme Court judge there. Like, right as the movie starts, like, later that day, he's going to get married to this girl. And he's like, I'm going to hide here until the time comes when I'm given my orders to strike, or when the Fourth Reich gets ready to start up, or what have you. Edwin G. Robinson plays the agent who's in looking for him, basically. Yeah. He knows that there's someone here because he's followed a guy.
Step him out. Yeah.
He's followed another another German spy. They know who he is to this town and are trying to figure out who his contact is. Now, Welles, before the guy can, Edwin G. Robinson can close in on him, kills the other guy, hides the body on his wedding day, no less.
But wouldn't you know it?
So starts a series of steadily, building paranoia for his character as he's starting to realize that all this might actually end with him having to kill his own wife-to-be if he has to, because quite frankly, he is a Nazi and he's going to get out of this any way he can. And it is a pretty thrilling story. Unfortunately, as near as I can tell, next to no effort was made in transferring this to Blu-ray. It looks like absolute shit.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out what it is that they did that to fix this up at all, but it just looks terrible almost. There's absolute scratches all over it that go all throughout the whole thing. I mean, it's just, I don't get it. It just looks like there was next to no work, and neither is the audio all that great, but you know, the truth is this is actually a really good film. It still looks more than good enough that it's worth looking at this way. I mean, this is still the best copy that exists of this film.
Right.
And it is considered to be an important Orson Welles piece in his history. Mm-hmm. So, still well worth a look.
Excellent. Well, I will definitely have to check that out then. From there, we're going to ride into High Plains Drifter, which is the second feature film directed by some guy named Clint Eastwood.
Was it his second film?
It was his second feature film. He did like a documentary short as well before that. But his first theatrical film that he directed was Play Misty for Me. And then High Plains Drifter.
That's a great movie too.
That actually, I'm putting together a marathon that's probably going to take me about 3 days. A few years ago, I did a marathon called Bronsathon, where for 3 days I did nothing but watch Charles Bronson movies. And I think we got through about 20 of them. And I'm going to do the same thing with Clint Eastwood because I realize there's a lot of movies in Clint's catalog I have not seen.
Oh, there's a lot of great ones.
I've seen this one, actually.
Well, as well you should. High Plains Drifter was the first Sergio Leone Clint Eastwood film that Sergio Leone had absolutely nothing to do with. It was Clint being smart enough after doing a series of Westerns for other people other than Sergio that weren't quite there. They were fun, but they weren't
Joe Kidd
enduring classics. Yeah. Two Mules for Sister Sarah films. Yeah. They're good. They are good, but they're just not great. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
This was him realizing that what it was missing was this style of those classic films. And in fact, here he is not the same man with no name. There's no poncho, but a man with no name. He is just credited as the stranger as he rides into a...
So we went from the stranger to a movie where Clint Eastwood plays the stranger.
Exactly.
Nice.
Where he rides into a mining town of Lago, where right off the bat, he is basically taunted by three jerky guys and he kills them as you do. And then immediately rapes a woman.
There's really
who's
not a better way
him.
To describe what happened.
No. That's it. He rapes her. He throws her down on the hay and says, "I know what woman like you need," and yanks his pants down and shoves it up her, which she immediately starts going, "Okay, this isn't all bad."
Oh,
I know.
The 70s.
Things were a little different. But when after all is over, everyone in the whole town is kind of freaked out. But they're like, "Look, the sheriff who used to be in this town was whipped to death by these group of gunfighters. And the sheriff that's there now, who's an ineffectual, heartless dolt, said, look, they were drunk and passed out and I handcuffed them and put them in jail. And so they're in the prison some miles out now, but they're getting out tomorrow. And we know they're going to come back here for revenge. Can we hire you, stranger, to help us defeat these guys when they come back to town?" And he's like, "Well, what do you have to pay me with?" He's like, "You can have anything you want." And so proceeds a series of him going around the town with his new midget friend who lives there and literally taking anything he wants in absurd and fun ways while fucking with every last person in this town. The weird thing is about this movie is he keeps having dreams from the viewpoint of the sheriff who was whipped to death, which how he would ever know that. Well, you can't say too much because you got to wait till the end of the film for the big spooky surprise.
Yeah, it's not something you get too often in a Clint Eastwood movie is a big spooky surprise, but that's what you get here.
And it does end with this weird, big action set piece that is really creepy. There's a scene where he's whipping one of the guys himself, and the town, which is on fire behind him, is just taking up most of the frame, and he's more of an outline than not. And he's just whipping this guy who's in pain, brutally seeing blood lash up from him. And it's genuinely haunting to watch. This is a true Western classic, a Eastwood classic, and a film that's not like anything else he ever did in some very specific ways that I don't want to say until you see it. It's kind of surprising, and I love the shit out of this movie. Now, unfortunately, this 40th anniversary edition comes with literally not a single special feature.
What?
Which is startling, since they put 40th anniversary edition and you're like, and?
Yeah.
An award for that? You just put it out on Blu-ray. Okay, fine. That's it.
So, that's weird. Is it its first time on Blu-ray?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. Possibly. But I think it is the first
yeah,
time.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, no, yeah. It looks like it is. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, all you get is it on Blu-ray. And it looks terrific. It's a great transfer, but nothing else on here but that.
Hmm.
So, but hey, man, like I said, it doesn't get much better than this. So.
Right on. Well, take us to, Chris, if you would, The Colony.
Do I have to?
You put it on the list, so yes, you do.
You know, I really liked the trailer for this new sci-fi film. It's a 2013 Canadian sci-fi horror film. They got a limited release in Canada, and it looked pretty fucking cool. I mean, it's got Lawrence Fishburne and Bill Paxton in it, for Christ's sakes.
Those guys have never been in anything bad.
Well, not together. I thought statistically speaking. It's the year 2045. It's a new ice age. Humanity is fucked. There's a few colonies left that live in, I don't even know what the fuck they are, giant underground colonies. Where it's like, the colonies aren't big, just the underground areas are pretty big. Where in this one, we're like at Colony 7, is run by Lawrence Fishburne with Bill Paxton as his number two. And it's clear there's a lot of tension because they've come to a point where apparently there's a very common virus that goes around that is incredibly easy and is completely fatal. So anytime anybody so much as gets a sneeze or a cough, they're put into quarantine. And if it doesn't go away after a week, they take them outside and kill them.
Whoops.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't believe I want to talk to that school nurse.
Nope. Apparently they've never heard of emergency.
Yeah, apparently not. But everyone's trying to figure out, what do we do now? We're dying out. There's no soil to use. We're living off the last of what we can put together here. We've got a lot of seeds, but there's nothing we can do with them. Everything's covered in ice.
Mm-hmm.
Rumors are that there'll be a way to reactivate these giant weather machines that humans had built to try and control this climate. But
were these built by the Legion of Doom?
I don't
weather know. Machines.
I know. don't think about it too much. But everyone gets weirded when they find out one of the other colonies they're in touch with, Colony 5, is just not communicating anymore. So they send a group with basically Lawrence Fishburne and two guys you don't know who they are. Two other guys, two younger guys.
And the red shirts.
Yeah, the red shirts. And they find out that there's a whole group of roving cannibals who, like, so sharpen their teeth and all that shit, have killed and eaten everyone in that colony. And then once they get there, they get chased out and are like, what are we going to do? We can't, like, there's nowhere else we can go. We've got to go back to our colony, but how can we not lead them back here? The answer is you can't. That's the plot of The Colony.
All right. Yeah. Well, okay, so... Not good then?
Well, yeah, it's not terrible. It's not one of those movies you're like, oh, rolling your eyes. The biggest problem is it's just kind of dull for most of it. Mm. You're like, okay, it's not hard to predict where it's going to go or figure out where it's going to end up. There's some nice moments here and there. Some characters you'd rather stick or be in the movie more aren't in it anywhere near enough, or get killed way too early in it. And I don't know, by the time it gets to the big climax in the end, there's nothing about it that doesn't seem kind of, we haven't seen 100 times before since the 80s.
Sure.
It's just, there's nothing really special or stand out-ish about this one. And like I said, there's nothing specifically I can point to say, this is why it's terrible. It's just, this is why it's just meh.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I can't really recommend this one, sadly. I wish I could, because I think it's a cool concept, but eh.
So, be forewarned, gentle viewer.
Yeah, this one will leave you a bit cold.
It will. Nice. So from there, I'm really excited to talk about this one. Even though I did not get a copy of this, it is one of my favorite classic horror films, and that is Eyes Without a Face.
This is the first time I got to see this. I was so excited that I got to see it. Got this from Criterion, which anything you get from Criterion, you should go, yes, and fist pump.
Yes.
You know?
And I did just get one in the mail today, so I am back in their rotation. So.
Which one did you get?
The Uninvited.
Yes, me too.
All right, we'll be talking about that soon.
Looking forward to that one, too. But this is a 1960 French-Italian horror film adaptation of a book by the same name. And
It's, les yeux sans visage.
It's odd that, like, when it first came out, it wasn't really strongly received. It wasn't until much later in the 80s when it got re-released that people went, oh my god, this film is gorgeous and poetic and incredible, yeah, that it really got the appreciation it deserves.
It's like a haunting tone poem as much as a horror film.
Oh, most certainly. And so much of it is just this just gorgeous visuals and sense of odd, eerie. It's not a ghost film, but it's got an eerie, ghostly like quality to it.
Well, the girl
thing.
The main girl in the movie feels like she's been dead the entire time. Like, she just has this sort of, like, she's wafting through every scene and she's not really connected to anything around her. And then of course the mask, and it's, yeah, just, what the fuck, man.
But you never thought about a connection to John Woo with this film, did you?
Not really, no.
Face Off?
White
doves,
yeah,
flying around.
Okay.
Yeah. Apparently he was a huge fan of this movie.
That makes sense.
It's strange to think that John Woo's influence came to some, like, one of his biggest tropes came from Eyes Without a Face, but it did.
Apparently that's exactly where it came from.
The idea here is that this girl had her face completely horribly disfigured in an automobile accident that was the fault of her doctor scientist father, who feels so guilty about it that he's kind of gone a little insane.
A little bit.
And with the help of his assistant, who he also helped recover from a horrible, some sort of facial disfigurement at some point, who's completely loyal to him, they are abducting young, beautiful women and doing experiments to remove their faces and sew them onto the daughter's face. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, not like in a Frankenstein-y sort of way, but in a sort of like, hey, it'll just look like her face and she'll look like a normal woman again, because he's a very high-level scientist, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is, it just keeps not working and more girls have to die and the daughter slowly becoming sort of like, she is like the light and the scientist is like the darkness, and she doesn't want this. She just wants to die.
Yeah.
You know, and they won't let her. And there's all this fascinating subtext going on with character and personality and metaphor, but ultimately it's just such a beautiful looking film.
Yeah.
It really is. And the ending is just jaw-droppingly gorgeous.
And for the era it was made, the surgery scene is
disturbing.
Very disturbing. And in fact, there's a famous story about a woman like screaming and passing out during the premiere of this film, which of course they used to sensationalize it and used in the marketing of the movie. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a gorgeous film. It's one that I remember seeing with a buddy of mine shortly after I moved here for the first time. And I was completely awestruck. I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. It was quite an experience.
Oh yeah. No question. I, you know, it was one of those sit up in your seat at just the beauty of the images that you're seeing in this film that was incredibly influential with any number of different directors. I mean, especially this, of course, being Criterion, it comes with a nice booklet and there's a lot of list of films and directors that were really directly influenced by this movie that you'll go, wow, I would never have occurred to me until it was brought up to me that this was the case. But there you go. There's a lot of extra features in here as well, most of which were done on the original DVD that came out in 2004. There's exception of a new 8-minute interview with one of the actresses that just is about to turn 76, who plays the daughter, the one in the mask. The photo and art gallery hasn't been ported over, but one of the coolest extras is there's a short documentary in here by the director called Blood of the Beasts, which was about sort of meatpacking factories, basically, and slaughterhouses, that was really highly touted at the time as a major art documentary. Like, people were very influenced by it in horror because the way it intercuts scenes of children playing with animals being slaughtered. And apparently, I haven't got a chance to watch it, but apparently it's pretty incredible. There's even a documentary about it as well. There's lots of sort of little bits and pieces here and there, like a French television excerpt about, like, that talks to him. There's a lot of good stuff. This is a classic. If you're into horror, and especially if you're into like the classics of horror, like the origins of it, this is essential viewing. No question. And it is also no question my pick of the week.
Right on. Well, from Eyes Without a Face, why don't we talk about
Eyes Without a Face, forget the human race, your eyes without a face, which, by the way, was in fact influenced by this movie.
Hey, I'm so glad I got to hear that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So from there, let's talk about In the Flesh.
In the flesh.
In the flesh.
Ah, there's something in my flesh. I don't like it. Get it out. Get it out, Brian.
It's in the flesh.
It's in the flesh.
No.
This is a three-part BBC supernatural drama series, which started airing 2013. The BBC has its own zombie television show. What? I bet you didn't know that.
Well, I mean, they had, what was that one called? Dead Set. That was really
good.
It's
a miniseries.
Oh, what?
That was just a miniseries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was a standalone thing.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Now,
okay.
Even though this is just three parts, it's 3 hours long, it's the first season. They've already commissioned a second season. Lately, the BBC, who already were doing 13 and 8 episode seasons, have now decided, oh, what, America's doing that now? Well, fuck you. We're going to do 3 and 4 episode seasons.
Eventually, it's going to be like, we're going to do the pre-title sequence and then end of season.
All we do is trailers now. Like, come on. Stop it with that bullshit.
A show that will never be made.
I would argue that 8 episodes should be the bare minimum for any television season. And 13 should be about the maximum. 13 or 15.
Yeah.
But that being said, this is a very different take, to say the least, on the zombie drama. Here, it takes place after the best, better part of the zombie apocalypse is over, in that they've figured out, even though these people are genuine zombies, they're not viral zombies, they're like zombies, they died and came back to life. They figured out that they can give them regular daily injections that reactivate their brain, basically, make it start functioning again and stops the rotting, decomposing process.
Mm-hmm.
Never reverses anything, but they behave like they did when they were alive. They remember everything they did when they were alive. They act like they did when they were alive. Body parts aren't falling off and they don't crave brains anymore.
Hmm.
And
helpful.
And so, you know, I mean, they've got it. It's easy to it's easy to get the stuff. There's every town's got people whose job it is to, you know, be social workers for the once dead, now back alive, and help them reintegrate into society. And it features a young man who's come in and is trying to get back in, and the whole thing is it's called the partially deceased syndrome, PDS. The whole thing is an allegory for homosexuality, because there's a lot of one of the big stories here is his best friend comes back from the Gulf War, and he clearly died. He's got giant scars on his head where he was stitched back together. Mm-hmm. But his father, who was the leader of a group of people who saved the town during the midst of the apocalypse, you know, sort of a self-organized military organization who now are no longer useful. His father is the guy who's still lynching the dead when he can find them there, even though they're still even though they're completely conscious and like normal people now.
He's just that prejudice against the formerly dead.
Exactly. But when his own son comes back, he refuses to accept that his son is one of them. Just won't acknowledge it at all.
Yeah.
There's a lot of subtext going on.
There might be a little bit of...
It's just text.
Different meaning. It's super text.
Super text is so on top of it. But it's actually a pretty damn good show. It's not terribly action-packed. There's not a lot of that going on. So if you're expecting that kind of zombie drama, if you're one of those people who complain when The Walking Dead has a few episodes that are just people talking to each other, this is not your show.
I just want to see people kill some damn zombies.
Because it's a drama. But it's a fascinating concept, and it's kind of cool. Like, they all have to, like they're kind of forced to put on face makeup and wear contacts, because when they're not, they look like zombies. Huh. Their skin is all gray and mottled and veiny, and their eyes are all dead looking. And it's like, this is kind of a neat idea.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see where it goes after 3 episodes. So far, I'm with it, but not, I wouldn't call myself in love with it. I'm like, this is interesting, but where are you going to go from here?
Right.
Like, it's like one of those ideas, like, I like the idea, but how far can you really develop this?
Sure.
Yeah. So we'll see.
No, I mean, it's
so far, I'm saying it's well worth the look, especially with only 3 episodes to watch. You're like, okay, worth your time.
Right on. Well, from there, why don't, Chris, I want you to give us a lecture on the untold history of the United States.
What do I look like, Oliver Stone?
You look like the person who saw this.
I did. I actually didn't get a chance to watch all of it, sadly.
Oh, this is Oliver Stone.
But I actually will. And say what you will about Oliver Stone.
I will.
Does a lot of stuff about conspiracies and things like this. This has got no conspiracies in it. It's not what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it sounds like, oh, and now we're going to look into who really killed JFK.
Right. When you say things like untold and it's Oliver Stone, you assume he means it's untold because they don't want you to know.
Actually, this was a documentary miniseries for Showtime. And the idea here goes from basically the beginning of World War II all the way to modern day. And it's all fact-based. Like, everything in here, you can check your facts. In fact, the copy I got sent came with, like, a fucking giant book. Like, huge. Like, you could stop a door with this book. of, like, just, like, everything in it, but with, like, all references and everything. I mean, it's not... I mean, I even was researching this online. It's like, there's nothing in here that's not true. It's just the version of the events that you don't usually see people teaching in school.
Sure.
Which is to say, you know, things like, hey, guess what? America had almost nothing to do with Germany being defeated in World War II. came in at the last minute, took all the credit. You know who beat the Germans in World War II?
The Russians.
The Russians beat Germany in World War II.
Yeah.
Or did you know that the Russians and America were next to best friends for a while?
Yeah.
Until, what's his face? Roosevelt died, mm-hmm. who was setting it up where they were our greatest allies and closest friends until Truman took over, and who was like a little nebbishy guy. I mean, he was the George W. Bush of his time. Completely. This little nebbishy guy who, like, was terrible in school, who had tried to open several businesses and they'd all failed. I mean, it was literally like he time traveled and became George W. Bush in the future. And who listened to nobody, who kicked out all of Roosevelt's advisors and only listened to basically barons of commerce to tell him what to do, who were all fiercely anti-communist for obvious reasons.
Right.
And was manipulated into stuff like, you know, basically intentionally, intentionally intimidating the Russians. Like, now this isn't the first time I've heard this, but it is true.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Japan, for instance, was defeated.
Yeah.
Okay. Defeated. They had lost. And the only thing they were waiting on to unconditional surrender, they didn't want us to kill their Emperor Hirohito, because he was like, as was described by, I think it was Eisenhower, I can't remember, killing him would be like the Romans executing Jesus was to us. It's like, he was a god man, you know? So it was like, look, just let him happen.
They didn't
want
to make
a
martyr out of him.
Yeah. But at that point, we knew it was over. Everyone knew it was over. Every war general pretty much had come out and said, what are you doing? Leave Japan alone. Just let them have their emperor and it'll be absolute unconditional surrender. But no, we wanted to drop the atom bombs on them because so much anti-communist fervor had been stirred up with Truman by this group of anti-communist, you know, people who were trying to take control of the government, basically, and has succeeded, as we can see today, that they dropped it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to make a point to the Russians, to show them what they could do if they didn't fall in line, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
the stuff that's like factually accurate, but nobody ever says that.
Yeah, it's the stuff that is sort of the subtext of events that are taught, and the whole thing with Russia and America. I mean, if you think about the fact that we pretty much gave Russia East Berlin, it's like we're gonna let you carve out your little piece of Germany now that this is all over. So I mean, there was absolutely a friendship, a unity between Russia and the United States before Roosevelt kicked the bucket.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. Like, I mean, like, Truman was convinced that, and like I said, this is obviously as far as I've gotten in the series, which is why I'm focusing on it, even though it goes all the way to Obama and talking shit about what Obama, some of the shit Obama did that we don't normally talk about. But, you know, like, Truman, like, came in after the fact, not really knowing a lot about politics, quite frankly, was forced into office by the far right wing, who wanted him there rather than Henry Wallace, who was like, who the people actually wanted, and so did the Democratic Party, who would have created a completely different reality we live in now. I mean, Truman single-handedly created the Cold War.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there would have been no Cold War without him. And like the arrangement that had been made with them, which was basically like, okay, you guys basically get Poland, because that was their buffer. They felt the only thing that made them feel like good. And the Russia had given them huge concessions to America and Britain with other like Greece and all sorts of stuff. I understand you need this for your own security. Like basically Truman turned around and said, my people tell me that you shouldn't have Poland and that communism is evil. So fuck you.
Good job, Truman.
Anyway, it goes on. I know I keep picking on Truman, but this goes through a lot of series of years and picks on people from both sides of the aisle, both Republican and Democrat, and saying like, hey, here's the version you always hear people say. Here's what actually happened and you can look it up. And it's actually well done. It mixes in film clips from famous movies that represent these periods of history and things that are, that I think is a cool thing to do, especially for people like you and me.
Yeah.
I mean, rather than doing a series of talking heads, the whole thing is narrated by Stone himself, who does it very dryly and without like a hyperbolic comment or anything like that. It's actually found it really entertaining to watch in a very educational way. And a lot of this, like I said, I already knew. I read a lot about this period, but it's a great refresher course. And I feel like one of those things that I would want a teenager to watch.
Sure.
To go like, hey, I know they're teaching you a lot of bullshit in school. Like, not really lies so much as not telling the actual
truth.
Just
maybe the glossed over version.
The glossed over version and lying by omission.
Yeah.
You know, and this, you should probably know what actually happened.
If for no other reason than to get comfortable with the idea that there are times to question what it is you're being taught as irrefutable fact.
Well, history is taught by the winners.
That's correct.
yeah. So I do actually really recommend this. I know a lot of people like to talk shit about Oliver Stone, but this, and so do I a lot of the time, but this is actually pretty goddamn good.
Well, he's on my shit list right now for talking so much smack about the ending of Breaking Bad, but
yeah, that's the main thing everybody's pissed off about now. Yeah. I was like, guys, seriously, are we going to keep holding on to this one thing? Let's move on.
You don't fucking talk shit about Breaking Bad, Oliver Stone. Not when your last movie was Savages.
That's, yeah, that was the weirdest part of that whole discussion.
It's like, you really want to talk about story construction and character development?
Unnecessarily violent. Wait, what?
What?
Didn't you make Natural Born Killers?
It wasn't Natural Born Ticklers. That's all I'm going
to
say.
I kind of want to see that movie.
We'll get to work on that script. But in the meantime, come along and ride with us on a fantastic voyage.
Yay. This is one of those movies I watched all the time when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
It was on TV constantly when I was a kid. And I can't count how many times I watched this, but I haven't seen this since pre-puberty. And I was like, I wonder if I'm still going to like this now. It's a 1966 sci-fi film about a bunch of people who get miniaturized and put into a ship, a submarine that's sent inside of a human body to try and destroy some blockages in his brain before he dies, mm-hmm. that because he has valuable information about spy shit or whatever.
Well, what it is the guy is coming over. I believe he's a Russian scientist, or he's a scientist that's helped develop the technology for miniaturization for both Russia and America. But he's figured out the secret to letting the miniaturization last longer than an hour.
Yeah, and so they have 1 hour to get in and get out.
And then he's attacked at the airport where he's coming over to America, so he's in a coma. So they're trying to go in and relieve the blood clot so he comes out of the coma so they can get the information.
You know, they know that somebody in the group, I don't know how they know this, but they know that somebody in the group going in is a spy, mm-hmm. like a bad spy. And so it's either Stephen Boyd, Raquel Welch, Edmund O'Brien, or Donald Pleasance.
I don't think
and it's... I'm going to let you take your guess about right there about which one it is.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, the downside of this movie is that there's absolutely no subtlety to, you know, the plot. You're like, okay, there's you will know 10 minutes in who the spy is. There's just no doubt about it. But the upside is... Well, first off, let me say, I really did enjoy the shit out of rewatching this movie. I had a great time with it. The upside is terrific, inventive as fuck, set design and special effects as they're going through this body. It's crazy the shit that they do.
It was really groundbreaking for its time.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun. I mean, some of you guys' only exposure to this might be the pseudo-remake Innerspace.
Innerspace, yeah.
With Martin Short, which is just only kind of a remake of it.
This is definitely a precursor to that film. In fact, at one point during this movie, they even refer to where they're going as Innerspace as opposed to outer space.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, it's a really fun movie in terms of watching the special effects and seeing what they do with it because, you know, this was a time when they weren't doing a lot of blue screen. They were doing more of the matte work, and this is a film that sort of pioneered sort of a combination of the two, and it's also directed by Richard Fleischer, who has done a shit ton of classic films from Tora 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 to Silent Green.
Wait, is it the Letterbox?
What?
Oh, no. I thought you said Torgo.
Oh. No. He also did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So, I mean, this is a guy who's done his catalog is unbelievable. And I really did enjoy it. And the two movies we're kind of talking about in this vein, because they're both recently released by Fox, and they both are about submarine voyages. This one is the one that takes itself a little bit more seriously.
Well,
it's still campy in, you know, in what you're looking at and what you're watching and the setup, but at no time are they, I don't know, at no time does it feel lighthearted as a film.
No, and it's also a lot more fun to watch
it
than
is.
The other one.
It is.
Because it's wildly creative. All the set design and the effects and just, you know, even just the dialogue is well written in here on the whole. It's a fun movie.
And every few minutes they're being attacked by some part of the body that I'm pretty sure we don't actually have.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's always like stuff is always happening and it's really fun to watch. As opposed to, unfortunately, the other film that was released by Fox, which is Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, which is an Irwin Allen disaster movie set in a submarine.
In more than one way.
Yeah. And the biggest problem here, the biggest problem with this film is that it's boring. It is so dull. And it starts off very lighthearted. In fact, for the first probably 10 minutes of this film, I thought it was a musical and somebody just forgot to write songs. Because all the setup, like, you and I are dating. Oh, there's a woman dancing on the ship. I don't approve of this. Like,
and, you know, I mean, which is boring, though, as it's going on. It's basically the first 20 minutes of this film is a tour of the ship.
Yeah, they're just touring this submarine.
Which,
like,
there's not much interesting about the submarine.
No, because it's a very limited set.
Yeah, exactly.
And then a miniature.
But they end up, they're in under the Arctic ice cap, and the ice begins to crack and melt, and they're forced to dive really, really deep. When they come back up,
Armageddon happened.
I'm pretty sure this isn't possible, but the Van Allen radiation belt is on fire.
Yeah.
So the whole sky is aflame. The temperature is rising super rapidly. And it looks like they have a time limit to when all life on Earth will cease when it just gets too hot.
Right.
But the commander and his faithful Peter Lorre scientific assistant.
I like dolphins.
Who is literally Peter Lorre, for the record. I don't mean he's Peter Lorre-ish. He's
no,
Peter Lorre.
He's very much Peter Lorre.
Have come up with this plan that involves, whatever, technobabble. Something about launching a missile.
They're going to go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench and then launch a missile. And it. Okay,
it's
sure.
Technobabble.
Yeah,
it's,
it is technobabble.
And it takes forever to get there. And all you know is, like, a lot of the sailors on the ship, they don't believe in this plan. They just want to go die with their families or take the chance that the alternate plan, which the entire rest of the world thinks is the only viable one.
Which is to do nothing.
Yeah, which is it'll burn itself out before it gets too bad.
The alternate plan is to do nothing.
They've sent submarines after them to kill them. And all this sounds very exciting. It's not.
It really is.
And it's so dumb at points. There's just, like, they encounter problems along the way, like things go wrong with the sub, and at one point they go out of the sub, and what do they encounter? Of course, a giant, stupid-looking squid.
Yeah.
And I mean really fucking Irwin Allen stupid-looking.
Which is funny, because we just talked about a movie directed by the director of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This one's directed by Irwin Allen, and at points feels like a bad ripoff of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
It does indeed. I was excited to watch this, because every once in a while, Irwin Allen films are fun. Every once in a while.
Every once in a while.
Even for Irwin Allen, this is a bad film.
I will say that both of these transfers are pretty exceptional. These movies look really, really
and
good.
Fantastic Voyage, like I said, is like also comes with a lot of extra features as
well.
A
ton of extra features, yeah.
So, you know, if you had to pick up one of these, that's clearly the one to get. In fact, you should.
Be. Yeah.
You should. It is a sci-fi classic.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, those are our two submarine adventures for the day. So from there, we're going
What's the subtext of those films?
The subtext. Filmed in Periscope.
I hate myself.
I do too. So from there, we're going to talk about our last title of the day, which is Drug War.
Oh, I'll have a drug war with you, motherfucker. You want to go? You want to go?
No, I don't have
any. All right, hit this.
Okay,
go ahead,
thanks.
Take it.
Yeah.
Take it.
Yes! You ever think, like, human beings were meant to have three hands instead of two?
Okay, you clearly lost. Drug War is a Chinese Hong Kong film directed and produced by the great
Johnny Toe.
And you may not know who Johnny Toe is. That means you don't watch a lot of these.
You should figure it out real fucking quick.
Johnny Toe is kind of the master, modern day master of the gangster films, really. Mm-hmm. He has done so many great ones that I wouldn't even know where to start.
No, I think here's what I'm going to say. If you want to get into his films, the two that I would recommend immediately seeking out and watching are Vengeance and Exiled.
Okay.
Those are my two favorite.
And the Moment of Romance series is really, mm-hmm. really big as well, which, believe it or not, are action. But Full Time Killer was my first thing with him, because actually the writer was a guy who used to work here in town at Vulcan Video that I knew.
Oh, wow.
That I used to trade shit with.
That's random.
Yeah, kind of weird. But this is one of his best films in years. The idea being here is that the version of the DEA there, basically, have captured a drug lord, a guy who manufactures huge quantities of crystal meth in multiple warehouses across Hong Kong. And there in China, if you have more than like a handful of crystal meth, you're going to be executed. They kill you. That's the death penalty. And he's like, fuck that. I don't give a shit. I will totally turn on anyone. I do not give a shit. I will give you so many people. And as it turns out, he actually is very tied into the entire network. Like, he knows who everybody is in the drug scene there, but it's going to take some setup. You know, it's still the police still got to do things the way the police do. So he ends up in a situation where he has to work with them. It's, I don't know if undercover is the right word, because he's just being himself what he did, but they've sort of replaced a guy named Ha Ha, because he's constantly laughing, who's a minor drug lord who's trying to work his way up, with a police captain, and are trying to worm their way into meeting all the higher-ups eventually so they can bust them all. The problem is that as we become aware, it's not hard to catch on pretty quickly that this guy they've captured, who is, you know, helping them, is looking for any opportunity to get out of this situation. He does not want to turn on all these people, but he doesn't want to die either. So he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, and he's a piece of shit. So you watch this eventually build to this point, and it's very nerve-wracking watching this go on until it ends in like a gigantic bloodbath.
As you can expect from a Johnny Toe film.
Oh my god. Holy shit, is it a bloodbath. I mean, it's, if anything else, I'm reminded of the scene in Heat.
Oh, nice.
The classic Heat scene, you know?
Yeah.
And this is terrific, you know, drug dealers versus cops, twisty, lots of different elements going on, lots of terrific performances film. It's, if you like that sort of thing, this is well worth your time. And it's not as high on action as some of his films, strangely, but it has such great performances all the way through it. Really well-written plot. And it's one of those movies you watch it and you go, I'm pretty sure Hollywood's already remaking this. I'm pretty sure.
Nice. Nice. Right on. Well, I'm definitely going to track down Drug War, because I'm a big Johnny Toe fan myself. That is all the titles we have to review this week, but I think we still have to do a giveaway, which we're going to in the form of something that we actually covered last week.
Uh-oh.
And that is Resolution, and we have a copy of the Blu-ray DVD combo to give away. Now, if you remember, this is the film in which a guy goes to a cabin, or I guess an abandoned house, really, to help his friend detox from his crystal meth addiction, handcuffs him to a pipe, and then proceeds to slowly uncover a really twisted, weird mystery going on. Bad things ensue.
And a good movie ensues.
Indeed, a very good movie ensues. So for Resolution, the way we do giveaways now is we give you a sort of creative writing prompt. You go into the comments section on this post and answer that prompt, and then we just pick our favorite, and that person will win a Blu-ray DVD copy of Resolution. And here is my creative writing prompt for you for Resolution. Let's say you're in this cabin. You've handcuffed your friend to the pipe to keep him from hitting the pipe, and you find a Viewmaster is the only media form that you... It's like, what the hell is this old Viewmaster doing here? And you put it up to your eyes, and you see the scariest thing you could think of, which is... And that is the writing prompt.
And then you tweet about it. And then you're like, wait, why didn't I just look at my phone?
So tell me what... And it could be legitimately scary. It could be funny. Whatever you want it to be. But what is... How would you answer the question? The thing I see in the Viewmaster that is totally terrifying is...
Yada, ya.
Yada, ya. And we will pick our favorite, and that person will win. And I need to say this, because we haven't been doing this. We haven't changed our rules one bit as far as stipulations on who we can send the giveaways to, but recently it's kind of been a problem. So I will say this emphatically, guys, we still cannot send giveaway prizes outside of the U.S. I've had this come up like two or three
outside
times.
Outside of the continental U.S.
And it wasn't a problem the first few weeks we switched over to this new site and this, you know, different version of the show, but recently it's kind of come up a few times. So I want to make sure I state that. This giveaway is open to U.S. residents only.
And also, please, go back and check the comment section, or at least open your emails, which you should get from Discus, if you leave a comment with a opening, because we've had a lot of people who won, and we can't get them to get back in touch with us to send us their fucking mailing information.
We're trying to give you shit!
It's like, look, if you're going to make an entry, fucking read your email. What the hell?
We just want to give you shit. Well, yep, that's the giveaway, that's the show, and that's pretty much it.
Yep.
That's how we roll.
That is indeed how we roll.
In the 512.
That's how we buttered roll.
Dude, don't. The diet is killing me. Don't talk about buttered rolls.
Look at that blubber fly.
It's killing me.
This beer sure is tasty.
Stop it. Now, that's just hurtful. Don't do that. Look at this delicious water. My 12th cup of water today.
Oh, yeah, I'm jealous.
Pissing like an old man with a prostate problem, but anyway.
You know, I'd feel like shit if you were quitting drinking because you had a problem with drinking, but you're quitting drinking for your weight, so I don't have a problem with
it. I'm quitting drinking so I look better.
You vain motherfucker.
Yes, I am. Well, that's going to do it for us this week, guys. Please remember to listen, to go onto iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and leave us a review. Please do consider becoming a subscriber to the site and help us continue to bring you content. Also, please do consider using our links to get to Amazon, no matter what you're buying. That also supports us. We really appreciate it. But for Chris, this is Brian reminding you that I believe that as of right now, what is today's date?
Today's date is the 22nd.
It's the 22nd, technically, now. So... Yeah. That means there are 9 more days till Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. 9 more days till Halloween, silver.
You're all dead.